www.ccb.org.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Cheryl Swoop's professional basketball career has been filled with firsts. She was the first WNBA player to score a triple-double, 14 points, 15 rebounds, and 10 assists against Detroit in July of 1999. She was the first woman to have a shoe named after her, Nike's Air Swoops. And this week she became the most prominent team sport athlete to announce her homosexuality. Jim Bozinski of Outsports.com joins me on the line from L.A. Jim, welcome to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks, Bill.
Cheryl Swoops is not the first active WNBA player to come out. What's the big deal?
Well, she's by far the most prominent. She could be considered the Michael Jordan or Magic Johnson of her sport. And the other two that have come out, one, Sue Wicks, who's also a very good player. But Sue basically affirmed the fact that she's a lesbian in like a one-sentence interview in a New York newspaper and then would not ever talk about it again. And the other player, Michelle Van Gorp, while it being applauded for coming out, was never the star that Cheryl is. I mean, Cheryl is by far the biggest star to ever come out in team sports.
In a well-orchestrated As Told To in ESPN the magazine, Swoop says that she's, quote, tired of being miserable. But most of the players and beat writers for the WNBA already knew that she was gay. Is she likely to suffer much backlash as a result of this announcement?
I would really doubt it. I think the big test in society would be when a man comes out in a team sport, then we'll really see how tolerant we are. But you're right, I think a lot of people knew Cheryl was lesbian, but this was sort of a public affirmation for her as much as anybody else that she could be open about herself and her partner and not feeling she has to hide about it. But I can't imagine she's going to have a negative reaction out of this.
You know, I can't help but be a little bit skeptical here. In the past few days, Cheryl Swoops has been interviewed by CNN, Good Morning America, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, just about everybody in between. And in almost all of those interviews, she has mentioned her paid endorsement of Olivia Cruises, which is a travel agency that caters to lesbians. The impression that leaves, whether intentional or not, is that Swoops got paid to come out of the closet.
Well, I guess in a sense you can say she came out for both love and money. the New York Times reported that she had filed for bankruptcy, so she definitely needs the cash. But I think in this environment, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, cash does rule and commercialism does rule, and this is how a lot of things are announced via some sort of endorsement deal. Mm-hmm. So the fact that she did it maybe for the money, it's still a pretty brave thing to do. I mean, you're not going to find how many male team sport athletes who are closeted are going to decide now to come out? I would doubt hardly any. So this isn't some kind of like gold rush that she started.
It's terrifically ironic, though, it seems to me, because I remember back in the day when Martina Navratilova announced that she was a lesbian, and one of the fears was I'm going to lose all my endorsement contracts, and here you get one for coming out.
Well, I guess it shows the clout of the gay dollar. I think marketers and corporations have realized that you know, gays and lesbians have money like other, you know, sort of consumer niche groups. And in a case of a lesbian tour thing, you talk about a niche of a niche. it's actually perfect. This is one endorsement that she's not going to have to worry about losing, because the reason she's public is because she got this endorsement in the first place.
Interestingly enough, when the WNBA began, the league used images of a pregnant and married Cheryl Swoops to promote the league, and still, she's one of the league's most publicized players, but the WNBA has always been very reluctant to acknowledge its lesbian players and the number of lesbians in its fan base. Can the WNBA now afford to distance itself from one of the most prominent players they've ever had?
No, and I think that's one of the sad things, is the way they've handled the whole issue, as if by ignoring it, it would go away. I have no sense that they're going to distance themselves from Cheryl, but they probably also won't go out of their way to market or promote themselves within the lesbian community, even though they do support the WNBA at a very high percentage.
Cheryl Swoop's announcement doesn't change one fact. In men's major professional sports in North America, there is not one active, openly gay team sport athlete. Do you see that changing anytime soon?
I think it's inevitable that it's going to happen, because I think society definitely is changing, but I don't think Cheryl's going to have any impact on that. You know, what I seem to think, and a lot of other people seem to think, is that it might happen organically, where a kid in high school who's a terrific athlete is out And by the time he reaches the pros, he's been known to be out for whatever, 8 to 10 years. So it's no longer that big of a deal. Because when you look at the way young people, especially, you know, 15 or younger, they seem to be more comfortable with homosexuality, as a recent Time magazine article pointed out. So I think as society, in essence, advances in terms of just years, you're going to find that group becoming more and more prominent. At some point, it's probably going to be a non-issue, but it's not going to happen, I don't think, you know, tomorrow or even next year.
Jim Buzinski is CEO of Outsports.com, a website for gay sports fans and athletes. Jim, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, thank you.
This week's World Series triumph by the Chicago White Sox marked the second year in a row in which a team long denied a championship chowed down on victory. The White Sox had not won since 1917. Last year's champions, the Boston Red Sox, hadn't won in 86 years. Richard Justice, a columnist for the Houston Chronicle, feels this year's fall classic woke the populace to the delights of a heretofore remote possibility.
Until this year, the World Series had never been in Texas, and I think it had been one of those things. Oh, the World Series, they have that thing on television. That thing happens every year in New York or Cincinnati or Boston. But I think once you've had it, then, you know, expectations get raised a little more.
That expectations should rise in Houston, never home to a World Series champ, comes as no surprise. All four series games were close. But what about the other team in Texas? The Rangers, like the Astros, have never won the World Series, but according to Kevin Sherrington of the Dallas Morning News, Rangers fans are not necessarily expecting their day to come anytime soon.
Ranger baseball only goes back to 1972, which case we inherited the Senators, so we weren't exactly getting a great pedigree to start with. You know, it doesn't go back to your father and your grandfather and your great-grandfather. It's been more of a situation where, boy, they've never been good, but at least we've got the Cowboys.
The sour grapes compelled me to ask Kevin Sherrington whether anybody in his neighborhood would watch the Rangers in the seventh game of the World Series if the aforementioned Cowboys happened to be playing on the same night.
And they would, but it'd be a struggle. They'd certainly have that picture-in-a-picture maybe going.
Perspective is not limited to teams in Texas cities. According to John Paul Morosi, a columnist with the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, the Mariners, no stranger to playoff baseball during the late 90s and a little beyond, can count on fans inclined to enjoy the ride as far as it goes without bitterness or angst.
They haven't really had one of these epic burns where they're almost there and they just kind of get tortured at the last second. The Seattle fans are pretty good-natured folk when it comes, I think, to just kind of enjoying the game. It's just, there's not that, I don't think, deep-seated need to win. You know, when they leave the park, it's a beautiful night in Seattle, and it never rains in the summertime, so they're out there, it's, you know, 75 degrees, no humidity, and the sunshine. They're like, yeah, life's not too bad.
All this would seem to suggest that if the pattern of rewarding, long-suffering, desperate, even sociopathic fans with a World Series championship is to continue in 2006, the winner is a lot less likely to come out of Seattle or Texas than it is to emerge from perhaps Cleveland or maybe the other side of Chicago. The Temple University football team currently endures a perfect season. The Owls are 0-8, and most observers expect them to finish without a win for the first time since 1959. But don't tell that to the players. They're still trying to win one more for outgoing coach Bobby Wallace. Reporter Joel Rose of member station WHYY in Philadelphia went to the Owls game against the vaunted University of Miami on October 15th, and he filed this story.
Technically, it was a home game for the Temple Owls. But looking around a largely empty Lincoln Financial Field, a 68,000-seat stadium that's also home to the NFL's Philadelphia Eagles, it was hard to tell. It seemed like half the 23,000 fans in attendance wore the orange and green of the Miami Hurricanes. Number 7 Miami put the game away early, scoring 4 touchdowns in the first quarter. Still, Temple partisans like John Gazzara tried to be optimistic.
Well, they held them to 27 points in the first quarter. That's good.
Miami was up 34-0 in the second quarter when Temple set up for a long field goal attempt. Temple did eventually get on the board, losing by a final score of 34-3. That outcome did not particularly surprise Temple sophomores Michelle Palmer and Katrina Harris.
I know it sounds bad, but we came already expecting them to lose, but we still wanted to show school support because I love Temple, even though I knew they were going to lose anyway. I still wanted to come and support. They're trying, and we applaud effort. We're rooting for effort today.
We applaud effort. Yay.
Of course, some fans would like to see more than just effort. Owls fan Kim Wenzel says he's been to most of Temple's games this year.
I think they're better than what they play, so I think it's going to be something they need a whole new coaching staff to start over. It doesn't seem like there's any adjustments when things go bad out there.
The Owls haven't had a winning season since 1990. They were so bad that they were asked to leave their old conference, the Big East, in 2001. The Owls hope to be more competitive in the Mid-American Conference, which they're scheduled to join full-time in 2007, but that won't help them this year. Playing a brutal independent schedule, the Owls lost their first 8 games this season. Leading up to the game against Miami, the Owls were drawing only about 10,000 fans to their home games. That was just too much for Coach Bobby Wallace. Before the Miami game, Wallace announced he would step down at the end of the season.
What we've been through, the transition we've been through, has taken its toll on me. When we got here, we had no facilities and we're playing in the Big East. There were a lot of things that needed to be done. Those things have been done, but you know, I'm worn out. And I've got 5 more games in me, and I'll be in Gulf Shores, Alabama, and sitting on the beach.
Still, Wallace maintains that his team is in better shape than it was when he arrived 8 years ago. Defensive lineman Adam Fichter says Wallace helped lay the groundwork for a winner.
Since he's been here, we might not have the wins, but he's done tremendous things for this university, you know, getting us a practice field, getting us a home field now, a brand new state-of-the-art turf for us to practice on. I mean, he's just done great things, and hopefully the new coach that comes in will take the kind of initiative that he has, and this program's only going to go up.
And as defensive lineman Antoine Burton points out, there's really nowhere else to go.
You know, the only thing we do is get better, and that's what we work on each week.
Burton says the team is still hoping to pick up more wins. They have 3 games left against big-time opponents, including Virginia and Navy. For Only a Game, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
Keep the colors high. Roll that ball and hit the line. All the Temple stars will shine. Skill and courage win the game. Fight on, Temple, fight.
It's 19 minutes.
Details at fenn.org.
Maya Sullivan proves that blood is thicker than horse racing and sports writing. But first, the 2005-2006 NBA season begins on Wednesday. Here to preview the upcoming campaign is the New York Daily News' Mitch Lawrence, who joins me now on the line from New Jersey. Mitch, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank you. The San Antonio Spurs were not satisfied with their championship team from last season, and so they improved it by adding Michael Finley and Nick Van Exel. Did they really need all that help?
Well, that's a good question. They probably needed some more talent in terms of depth because last year they kind of survived in, you know, 7 games to beat Detroit. And they, you know, although they have the best player in the sport, and Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili is on the rise as one of the great young players, they probably could use a little more. And so they did get Finley and Van Exel, but it's going to be interesting, Bill, to see how those guys really fit in because, you know, they've been star players on teams in the past, so you always worry about how players will take lesser roles, and we'll see in this case if it works out.
The Phoenix Suns, on the other hand, owners of a league-best 62-20 regular season record last year, jettisoned Joe Johnson during this summer, and then they lost Amari Stoudemire to injury until probably February. Can they achieve this season what they failed to achieve last year, namely get to play for all the beans?
Well, it's going to be very hard without Amari Stoudemire because they're losing one of the premier young big men in the league, you know, 26 points a game, and a real reason why Steve Nash, their point guard, was the MVP. They're also changing their philosophy. You know, it's not going to be any more up and down and trying to outscore people. They've revamped their team, too, so they're trying to play with more, you know, defensive style and rebounding, emphasizing that. That sometimes, you know, doesn't necessarily translate well when you're trying to do that. But the big thing is you can't lose a player of Stoudemire's stature and really recover from that. And who knows if he'll even be back by the All-Star break. We don't know.
I saw a picture of Stoudemire in the paper the other day, and one thing the Suns won't have to worry about is he dresses very well. He'll be fine with the dress code, wearing a suit and everything.
Well, the dress code is this
is this thing, you know, most people think that the league is just a bunch of guys who are walking around in baggy jeans with throwback jerseys and do-rags. And actually, a lot of teams, I think the majority of teams already had a dress code, but David Sternfeld, there's really a disconnect, I think, with the general public in terms of some of the players and the people who buy tickets, and so he felt that he needed to have a dress code, which I don't, you know, on the bench, I don't necessarily disagree with, because that's really where players are seen. Most guys dress pretty well. They just felt like they had to put in some minimums. Now they're going to fine and suspend players who don't conform, but Stern said the other day he didn't feel that he's going to have to suspend anybody, and let's hope not, because it's really not a problem. But I think there is a general feeling in the public that they can't relate to some of these young players and what they see. So we'll see if the league's right or not in doing this.
The commissioner, it seems to me, is in a very peculiar position because he's worried about the image of how these players come across, and yet we've heard so much about their voluntary participation in hurricane relief efforts. Very admirable stuff. Why is he worried about the player's image?
Well, he's worried about the player's image because I think that he feels that there's a lot of corporate sponsors out there who really, despite how the players come across in their efforts with the hurricane, as you mentioned, I think they have problems with the tattoos and the hip-hop culture that is obviously a big part of the league because a lot of players are young black.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think he feels that even though the league has embraced hip-hop, you know, that at all-star games, at other functions, hip-hop is, they have hip-hop entertainers, and as Stern mentioned the other day, he even has people like, you know, Jay-Z and Nelly and Usher who are part owners of some teams. I think he feels that they're still a big part of the public that doesn't relate to these guys, people who would, you know, maybe are turned off and don't want to buy tickets. And David Stern, more than anything, is a big marketing guy, so he doesn't want to cut off that part of the population.
Let's get back to talking about some of the specific teams. As usual, Seattle, Dallas, Denver, Sacramento, and Houston are early season favorites to do well. Which do you think bear watching over the next 82 games?
Well, I think Denver has a real good chance to do real well. They're a team on the rise. They've got a good coach in George Karl. They have a good nucleus of some young talent headed by Carmelo Anthony. And they're a team, and I think Houston would be another team in the West. Under Jeff Van Gundy, they've added some significant players. They've got more talent, bringing in Stromile Swift and Derek Anderson to add already to Tracy McGrady. So I think those are the teams that you want to watch for. I think Seattle is probably going to drop back a little bit. And I don't know, did you mention the Lakers in that group?
I was just avoiding the Lakers.
Well,
I avoid them whenever I can.
Because Phil Jackson is back, and it's going to be real interesting. For the first time in a long time, he doesn't take over a team that you like, because you'd look at as just a championship contender right off the bat, because he doesn't have a real good big man. As he did when he left the Lakers, they had Shaquille O'Neal. But anyway, you know, we always have to keep an eye on Phil and Kobe Bryant because it makes for good reading, even if they're not very good on the court.
In the East, the New Jersey Nets will attempt to combine the talents of Jason Kidd, Richard Jefferson, and Vince Carter. Are they kidding or just Vinsane? I get it. See, it's funny because it...
I usually try to avoid those things, but actually, no, you know, it's looked at as one of the better teams in terms of the three perimeter players, but they just don't have the big man that you really need. They're going to be exciting, and they're going to be fun to watch. They're going to get up and down the court, and as long as Vince Carter's healthy, he's a premier player too. But what's going to really catch up with them, Bill, I think, is lack of a real quality front court player who's over 6'8".
All right. Now, Mitch, we have an only a game tradition, which is before the season starts, we ask our analysts to pick the two finalists and, of course, the winner of the NBA championship. So go ahead.
Not hard. San Antonio over Detroit. It's a chalk league. This is a league where unless Tim Duncan is going to go down to an injury, you have to beat the Spurs four times out of seven games.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit's going to be the premier team in the East. I think they're going to flourish without Larry Brown. I think they're going to beat Miami out for that with Shaq with his revamped team. And in the West, I think there's a big gap between San Antonio and everybody else. I think the Phoenix injury to Stoudemire really hurts. Last year I picked Detroit over San Antonio in seven. This year I'll go the other way and pick San Antonio over Detroit in seven. We'll see if I'm right.
Mitch Lawrence covers the NBA for the New York Daily News. He joined me on the line from New Jersey. Mitch, thank you very much.
Always happy to talk to another Montclair native.
Very close to the end of his life, veteran sports writer Mike Sullivan mentioned to his son John that Secretariat's performance at the Kentucky Derby in 1973 was the moment he remembered best from his career. That was enough to provoke in Sullivan the Younger an inclination to write about horses, horse racing, and some of the remarkable people who've populated the world of the thoroughbred. The result is Blood Horses, Notes of a Sports Writer's Son. John Sullivan joins me now from the studios of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a brief overview of your dad's sports writing career.
He fell into it. He had just dropped out of college and was writing a lot of poetry, and he wrote a story for the AP, as I remember him telling it. It was about a woman in Kentucky who thought she was a witch, and he thought she was a witch, too, as it turned out. And the paper liked the piece and asked him if he wanted to do more, and sports were what he knew. I mean, he'd had these literary ambitions since he was a kid, but his own father had been a real sporting fanatic, and he always had this encyclopedic memory for sports and statistics, and so... And then finally he landed a beat, as they say in the trade, or you know, he became the regular reporter for a certain team. I think it was probably the Kentucky Wildcats football team in the beginning. And he sort of never looked back. He was not expressly a Derby writer. It was more the case that in Louisville, when the Derby comes around, they send pretty much everybody on the sports floor over to Churchill Downs because there are just so many stories to be covered and things to be followed up, so... So that was a bit of an accident, too, that he ended up writing about the Derby for several years and that he ended up being there in 73, Secretariat's year, and you know, which he really, I think, considered the highlight of his career.
You know, it strikes me that you were fortunate in getting the opportunity to ask your father what he remembered most clearly and with the greatest pleasure from his career, and he got the opportunity to answer you and give you that image of Secretariat. That was an important and touching exchange, no?
It was. It was. I've too infrequently... thought about how lucky a thing that was, really, because it was the last conversation I ever had with him face to face. And it was a wonderful conversation. It was actually a couple of days I was sort of in and out of the hospital where he was staying. He just had heart surgery. And I don't know if, you know, what it was, if he was really feeling his own mortality, but he was really in a mood to talk, despite the fact that he, you know, he wasn't able to smoke in the hospital. So usually time in the hospital for him was a kind of torment, but he was in a pretty good mood. And we had just had some wonderful conversations, including that one, which for me was, you know, of all the things, I mean, he was fairly reticent on a number of subjects, but work was one thing he just never wanted to talk about. He really didn't bring it into the house very often. And, so that was, it was wonderful for me, you know, to hear that, to hear him describe that race.
Like your father, you found some of the horses you encountered beautiful and admirable. You were less impressed by some of the people that you encountered. At one point, you write of the infield at Churchill Downs that it is, quote, a wonderful place to see a certain kind of Kentucky face made obsolete in other parts of the world by dentistry and nutritional guidelines. How do Kentuckians feel about reading that?
My family wasn't real happy about it. But, I mean, I was I was certainly impressed by those people, just in a different way. And in some ways, I'd never have dared to write sentences like that if I didn't feel that they were my people, in a way. You know, one of the things about the South, I mean, W.J. Cash, I guess, was the great authority on this. You never have to go too far back in any family line to find a bunch of squirrel hunters, you know. So I felt like I was... I felt like it was adequately implied that I was incriminating myself in lines like that one.
Well, just to establish that your observational powers are not limited to the infield and the people populating it, I will read what you have to say about the folks at the other end of the monetary spectrum. Again, quoting, "It is sad to be reminded that all this horse racing business is about the rich, for the rich are hideous. There is nothing they cannot ruin." Is that an observation your dad would have shared?
That's a good question. I never thought about what he would have thought about that sentence. I've sometimes felt a little ambivalent about it myself. There's some things, you know, a lot of these races, I was there partly in my capacity as a journalist. I was working for Harper's Magazine at the time. And sometimes you write these sentences that you wouldn't necessarily stand by if you were on a panel or something or in a more serious context, but they seem to belong to the moment. They seem to belong to the experience itself. And I feel like a lot of times, even when I'm writing nonfiction and trying to hew as closely to the truth as I can, I'm also dependent on a persona in some ways. And so I don't want to sound too creative writing-y about it, but the self that was there found those particular rich people fairly hideous in that moment. Yeah, I think it's safe to say.
Well, speaking of the rich, the Breeders' Cup takes place today at Belmont Park in Elmont, New York. Have you ridden yourself out of horse racing? Why aren't you there?
Well, my wife and I had a daughter a couple of months ago, so, you know, the phrase gambling away the kids' college tuition is no longer so charming in our household. But I'm not doing as much betting anymore. I still try to make it to Lexington for the Bluegrass Stakes, and I always go with my uncles to the track and make some bets there, but otherwise I've sort of scaled back. The other thing is that, you know, part of my job requires me to dance from subject to subject and get sort of unhealthily obsessed with something for 3 months and then kick it out of my brain to make room for something else. I'm not quite smart enough to have all those things in there jumbled together, you know, so.
Well, that's a good reason to stay away from the track if you're not feeling smart enough to be there, because so many people betting are so smart.
That's true. It's like Mensa, you know.
Exactly. It always reminded me of that whenever I've gone. Your father was a poet before he was a sports writer, but at one point he said to you, "I will never be what I thought I was." Did he consider becoming a sports writer a kind of surrender?
I've asked myself that many times since the book came out, and there were a couple of reviews I remember. There were a couple of reviewers who felt that I'd been a little hard on him in that way and said, you know, why is this necessarily a come down? And I'm not sure he ever really did see it as a surrender, because he was so passionate about his sports writing. And I don't think anyone who felt it was just sort of a day job or something he'd done after having failed at something else could have been quite that passionate about it. But I think he just knew himself in that way. That was one of the things I admired about him. He was clear-sighted that way, and he saw that he hadn't quite had what it took, you know, in his poetry, maybe hadn't been committed enough to it, or quite good enough, or whatever it was, you know. So he sort of let that go, almost like a booster rocket, you know, and just concentrated on what he could do.
It feels as if you wrote Blood Horses in part to get to know your father better, to give yourself that opportunity, but also in part to find some forgiveness for yourself for being a less than perfect son. Do you feel that you accomplished those goals?
No, I can't say so, honestly. I never looked to the experience of writing the book as a way of accomplishing that, more as a way of just coming to grips with the impossibility of doing that after someone's gone, you know. It did enable me to sort of fix my father in my memory and commune with him, I guess, after he was dead. You know, that was bittersweet in that way, because you're constantly dealing with the reality that after this person's gone, all these conversations that you thought you could still have, things you'd said that you thought you could take back, you know, the possibility of that is gone. But at the same time, I really felt that I was spending time with him during all those months. Really, it was a couple of years when I was learning about his life and just kind of digging through my own memory of the years I was with him.
John Jeremiah Sullivan is the author of Blood Horses, Notes of a Sports Writer's Son, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. He joined me from the studios of WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, mere muggles move to master the mysterious maneuvers of Quidditch. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
A lot of alliteration this morning.
And never enough. We have a new World Series champion. Was the White Sox 4-0 defeat of the Houston Astros the best World Series sweep you've ever seen?
No, of course. Last year's World Series sweep was better than this year's World Series sweep. You know, it was obviously much more closely played. Houston seemed to be more enthusiastic about their jobs than the Cardinals were a year ago against the Red Sox. The White Sox apparently were the best team in baseball wire to wire this year. The enormously fast start they got off of. And then we came to postseason, the White Sox, you know, playing very old school baseball, letting their starters go eight innings. I mean, Tony La Russa must have been getting the bends in his Barca lounger where he spends most of the postseason anyway. And lo and behold, they lose one game in the postseason. They're clearly the best team in baseball.
We also have a new Japan Series champion, the Chibolati Marines, under American manager Bobby Valentine, who proposed that his team play the White Sox for the true world championship. What do you think?
Oh, go. Let's do it. Let's play a one-game series, okay? And then the White Sox will win 153-0, and that'll pretty much be the end of it.
And the only question is, do they play it in Hawaii or Guam?
The only reason this is happening is that Bobby Valentine has never seen a television camera he couldn't throw himself in front of, so...
I would think that series, should it ever happen, would garner better TV ratings than the World Series did. I guess there's only room for improvement.
Yeah, this was a stinker. I mean, it's a 30% drop from last year, in which you had, of course, two of the signature franchises in both leagues playing, and with, of course, with the story of the Red Sox gaining momentum through the great comeback in the Yankee series. I don't think the White Sox in Houston ever had a chance. I got to tell you, I watched the games. I was entertained. What the other 153% of Americans were doing, I have no idea.
Charlie, is it safe to say that the people who produced the most recent Got Milk ad should have known that Major League Baseball has no sense of humor?
Well, I mean, this is really stupid. I mean, they're tweaking MLB a little bit for the steroid scandal. And, of course, the executive vice president for business of Major League Baseball, a guy named Tim Brosnan, who, as you pointed out, had a humorectomy at a young age. There is nothing humorous about steroid abuse. Now, I understand, having followed the coverage for a couple of years, that the United States of America has never in its history faced a greater crisis than the possibility that some baseball players are shooting stuff up into their bodies to get better. I realize the Civil War, the Great Depression, World War II, McCarthyism, the Panic of 1803, nothing compared to the fact that Barry Bonds may have rubbed a cream on his upper body. However, we all ought to be able to make some jokes about it at this point.
Doc Rivers, head coach of the Boston Celtics, dropped a pop quiz on his players this week, and it had nothing to do with zone defenses or options off the inbounds play. What those Marquette grads won't think of.
I'm telling you, we do put them out there, don't we? He asked his team what they knew about Rosa Parks, of course, whose act of civil disobedience kicked off the Montgomery bus boycott and therefore the modern civil rights movement almost 50 years ago. So after practice, he asked them if he could tell them some significant things. He made them talk about why she was protesting and how long the bus boycott was, which would have stumped me. It was 381 days. I thought it was closer to 2 years. Apparently, the players who passed were Gerald Green and Delonte West, who knew the law, and Brian Scalabrine. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for your historians on your Boston Celtics roster this year, there they are.
Pro football lost one of its links to the good old days of leather helmets, drop kicks, and family-owned teams this week when Wellington Mara died. He'd been associated with the New York Giants in one way or another for 80 years, and people are writing about him as if the NFL that we've come to worship might have been a very different sort of animal if it hadn't been for Wellington Mara. Is this a fair conclusion?
I think it certainly would have been different were it not for that founding generation, of which he was the last. And he was, of course, notable for his kind of hands-on relationship with the players and coaches there. Bill Belichick, for example, this week spoke very fondly of what the Mara, particularly Wellington Mara, did for him when he came there as a coach. He started as a ball boy in 1925, and the only time he missed a game or a practice was last spring when he started to get sick.
Are you practicing saying the phrase, the Los Angeles Saints?
The Washington Post has reported that the NFL will consider relocating the Saints to Los Angeles if New Orleans is, quote-unquote, unable to recover Katrina, which means build a stadium. The owner says he hasn't made any plans to move the NFL team to San Antonio. That, of course, doesn't mean he hasn't made any plans to move them to Los Angeles. Of course, Los Angeles is an interesting situation, as we discussed before. It almost functions better as a hammer on other cities as it does as an NFL franchise. The league is getting along fine without a team in L.A. L.A. seems to be getting along fine without a team in L.A. But L.A. is very useful if you want to build a stadium in places like Charlotte or New Orleans.
Air Force football coach Fisher DeBerry announced this week that, quote, Afro-American kids can run very, very well. How do you get to be head coach at the Air Force Academy without understanding that saying that might have some unintended consequences?
This is a bit of a kerfuffle. I mean, it was wrong-headed, but it certainly wasn't malicious. But Fisher DeBerry is sort of on double-secret probation for saying stupid stuff this year. After all, he was the guy who, with the apparent encouragement of a lot of people at the Air Force Academy who should have known better, was encouraging his players to become members of Team Jesus and foisting a fringe radical version of Christianity on them and making players feel uncomfortable if they didn't adopt it. He should probably lay off the socio-political comment for a couple of years.
Golfer and social activist Jean Vandeveld is making a statement in protest of women's participation in men's golf events, Charlie, and he will attempt to enter next year's Women's British Open. Can his contention that he has the right to compete stand the test of logic? And what is logic doing in this question?
Well, maybe Jean Vandeveld just wants to find another tour on which he can choke away big tournaments. Who knows?
But that may be it.
You know, he's using the, well, women can play in our tournaments, well, then why can't we play with them men excuse. Unfortunately, the Ladies Golf Union, which runs the Women's British Open, says it shall be the condition of any competition organized by the Ladies Golf Union that players must be of the female gender. Now, if Jean, or as he may soon be known, Jean, decides he wants to do this, he's got to go to full Monty. I mean, he's got to go the full Christine Jorgensen, let's go to Sweden and come back wearing different clothes routine. Otherwise, I don't want to hear his argument.
I don't want to hear his argument if he does that. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
I just remember my favorite golf mates. Then I don't feel so sad.
Though it's been 313 years since the Salem witch trials, people dressed in black capes and pointy hats are still a common sight in downtown Salem, Massachusetts, especially in October. On a recent visit there, Only a Game's Karen Given ran into several covens worth of witches. Despite their lack of aerodynamic vehicles cleverly disguised as simple home cleaning devices, they were well equipped with quaffles, bludgers, and snitches.
Okay. Wait, captain's calling timeout. There has to be a stoppage of play for that to occur. I can't stop the play.
In a tent behind the historic House of Seven Gables, Amy Tenbrink answers a few last-minute questions before the start of the inaugural American Professional Quidditch Association tournament.
Just make sure a ref sees you going, hey, time out, ref.
Tenbrink is a lead event organizer for the Witching Hour, a five-day Harry Potter symposium. Today's sessions will cover such weighty topics as visualizing the coming-of-age narrative in Azkaban and Mudbloods, Monsters, and Mad Women, Hermione Granger, and her dual role as a feminist social gauge. But for those who are interested in less academic topics, the schedule also includes a full day of Quidditch, the chaotic and fast-paced sport of the Harry Potter universe.
We created the American Professional Quidditch Association. We found 12 sponsors who wanted to sponsor a team, and then we created player shirts. So in the common today, you'll see 12 different teams running around in jerseys.
With numbers.
With numbers and names and custom mascots. I've never created a fake sports league before.
Quidditch isn't the easiest fantasy sport to bring into the real world. Those who've tried have had to get around the lack of enchanted snitches, magical charms, and of course, flying brooms. But at least Tenbrink can offer a real award, the Passaquoppa Prize.
It's a trophy. It's actually individual trophies for each player.
And are they, you know, Potter-ish?
No, they're very Little League-ish. All the games awards were sitting in my apartment a month ago, and I thought, I look like the Little League.
In J.K. Rowling's books, Quidditch is played in all kinds of weather, so maybe it's fitting that the day is forecast for steady showers. As the players arrive at the already muddy Salem Town Green, one team, dressed in hot pink t-shirts with matching pink and black striped knee socks, discusses last-minute strategy under the shelter of a stone gazebo.
We are the Everless Edibles Fizzing Wisbees!
Most of the Wisbees met in person only a few days ago, but they've been chatting online since the Quidditch draft in July. Almost since the books came out, people have been trying to play Quidditch in schools and even at Nimbus 2003, the previous incarnation of the Witching Hour Symposium. So have any of the Wisbees played before?
Of course not. 2 years ago.
No, half of us haven't, and we're just going all out. We don't care what we do.
As near as anyone can tell, this is the biggest full-scale Quidditch tournament to date, and real experience is hard to come by.
If you want to halt the game, for instance, someone's doing something serious like beta-heating something which isn't there.
Four beleaguered referees try to learn everything they'll need to know about the game in a five-minute briefing by referee coordinator Chris Dixon. It's a big job, but Dixon does his best to inspire confidence in his charges.
Enjoy yourselves. No one's going to overrule you. You are the foremost world experts in Quidditch.
All right.
The tournament begins with very little fanfare and much confusion, but it doesn't take the players or referees very long to get the hang of things. Chris Dixon is a good choice for referee coordinator. He's the one who mined the internet and formalized the set of rules to be used in this tournament. And he takes his job very seriously.
The rules for Quidditch are an evolutionary process. There have been a lot of attempts to create versions of Quidditch that can be played in the real world, frequently by educators who find it an interesting and relevant alternative diversion that can be used in physical education lessons.
Dixon has come up with a rule set he thinks will work, with some tweaks to the scoring system, an approximation of the hard-to-capture golden snitch, and attempts to make the game safer, since Madame Pomfrey isn't exactly on hand to magically mend broken bones. But there's one aspect of the Potter saga that Dixon is still hoping to capture.
We would like to try, if it were somehow possible, to get some aspect of flying into this. One of the aspects that we were considering but rejected was having players ride on each other players' backs. This would have been more true to the original in some senses, but it wouldn't have been very practical.
It would have been a mess.
It would, yeah.
As it turns out, the sport is messy enough with everyone's feet on the ground. Between the mud and the mayhem, real-world Quidditch is a jumbled combination of basketball, soccer, field hockey, and just about every other high school team sport. The punctuation pixies make their entrance on Salem's Town Green with a flourish, covered in glitter and humming the Imperial March from Star Wars.
Our theme song.
Yes. And how did that become your theme song? What does it have to do with being pixies exactly?
Because we're badass.
Yeah, badass.
Yeah. See, we look cute and sparkly, but that's our whole plan. A clever little ploy.
Yep. We're going to take them out.
The pixies are appropriately all women, and they're all a bit vertically challenged. But the pixies aren't worried, not even for their keeper, who must block shots thrown at suspended goals.
She's the tiniest one of us all, but she has kung fu powers that she can jump like 5 feet in the air. So.
Have you seen how high up the hoops are?
I did.
You sound a little scared.
I'm not. Woo!
She can do it.
The team eventually makes it to the field, passing out pixie sticks candies to spectators along the way. As the pixies meet their opponents, Minister of Magic Lacey Lovegood, known in real life as Kirsty Byrne, looks on with pride at the rivalries she's helped create.
The Fizzing Wisbees, as they are known, the Fizzing Wisbees are a candy in the Harry Potter universe, and we thought that is perfect. So we've got the Fizzing Wisbees versus the Pixies here. Pixies are all hyped up on pixie sticks. The Fizzing Wisbees apparently do not need any extra sugar. They are just hyped up as it is.
These teams only sprang into existence a little more than 2 months ago, but their team histories are rich, thanks to some creative profiles dreamed up and posted on the internet by tournament organizers.
If you actually look at our bios, it's like, the Fighting Owls have been known to be more towards physical violence than actually getting the stage door. We're going to gouge out people's eyes with their claws.
Melody is a baby-faced player from Florida who got her first chance to witness real-world Quidditch at Nimbus 2003. She was a commentator at that game, an assignment she says the organizers came to regret. Over the past 2 years, she might have cleaned up her language, but she hasn't lost any enthusiasm for the sport. Halfway through the day, she's already covered in mud, from her pigtails down to her once white tennis skirt.
Well, I did tackle the short guy.
Might I add, she made up her own move. It's going to be like a legendary...
It's called the Planetary Collide. It's going in Quidditch through the ages.
People will dodge when they see her because of that move.
I know. This guy's like twice my size, and I'm just like, roar!
Like most of the day's matches, the battle between the Fizzing Whizbees and the Punctuation Pixies passes by in a quick blur of mud, rain, and giggles, with the Whizbees catching the snitch for a decisive victory. Still reeling from his first-round loss, Nick Murato, captain and chaser for the Order of Merlin Dragons, probably should be resting up for the afternoon's playoffs. But he's helping out with the rest of the preliminaries instead. He sees Quidditch as a real sport, as real as it can be anyway.
See, the sport for muggles, it's still early in the sport, so it's testing things, way to run things. I think with a few tweaks, we should be at our optimal muggle build. I mean, obviously we're not flying. Obviously we're not, you know, elbowing each other and throwing them into the ground. But, you know, that's the closest we'll get on Earth as non-wizards.
Want to hear our cheer?
That's our yes, answer. Absolutely.
We are the minions of he who hears!
Who are we? Who are we?
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Salem, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from George Scheibner at WHQR in Wilmington, North Carolina. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view photos illustrating Karen Given's story on Quidditch, browse Only a Game show archive, sign up for our newsletter, or even hear Katarina Vitt flirt with me. Again, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Salem resident Dan Malice.
I'm the only world's only 47-year-old Quidditch player, put it that way. And the world shouldn't have more than one.
Well, don't tell that to the folks in the Masters Quidditch League. You'll be pummeled with flying brooms of fury. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.